Dark, moist, frigid, with ashen walls and cold tiles the color of lead. I spent as little time in it as possible. The university seemed to offer a new beginning, and I intended to take it. I enrolled in every course I could squeeze into my schedule, from German idealism to the history of secularism to ethics and law. I joined a weekly study group to practice French and another to learn knitting. The graduate school offered a free course on charcoal sketching. I had never drawn in my life, but I signed up for that too. I began to read Hume, Rousseau, Smith, Godwin, Wollstonecraft, and Mill. I lost myself in the world they had lived in, the problems they had tried to solve. I became obsessed with their ideas about the family, with how a person ought to weigh their special obligations to kin against their obligations to society as a whole. Then I began to write, weaving the strands I found in Hume's Principles of Morals with filaments from Mill's The Subjection of Women. It was good work. I knew it even as I wrote it, and when I'd finished, I set it aside. It was the first chapter of my PhD. I returned from my sketching class one Saturday morning to find an email from my mother. "We're coming to Harvard," she said. I read that line at least three times, certain she was joking. My father did not travel. I'd never known him to go anywhere except Arizona to visit his mother, so the idea that he would fly across the country to see a daughter he believed taken by the devil seemed ludicrous. Then I understood. He was coming to save me. Mother said they had already booked their flights and would be staying in my dorm room. "Do you want a hotel?" I asked. They didn't. A few days later, I signed into an old chat program I hadn't used in years. There was a cheerful jingle, and a name turned from gray to green. "Charles is online," it said. I'm not sure who started the chat, or who suggested moving the conversation to the phone. We talked for an hour, and it was as if no time had passed. He asked where I was studying. When I answered, he said, "Harvard? Holy hell!" "Who would have thought?" I said. "I did," he said, and it was true. He had always seen me like that, long before there was any reason to. I asked what he'd done after graduating from college, and there was a strained silence. "Things didn't go the way I planned," he said. He'd never graduated. He'd dropped out his sophomore year after his son was born, because his wife was sick and there was a mound of medical bills. He'd signed on to work the oil rigs in Wyoming. "It was only supposed to be for a few months," he said. "That was a year ago." I told him about Sean, how I'd lost him, how I was losing the rest of my family. He listened quietly, then let out a long sigh and said, "Have you ever thought maybe you should just let them go?" I hadn't, not once. "It's not permanent," I said. "I can fix it."
"Funny how you can change so much," Charles said, "but still sound the same as when we were 17.
My parents arrived as the leaves began to turn, when campus was at its most beautiful, the reds and yellows of autumn mingling with the burgundy of colonial brick. With his hayseed grammar, denim shirt, and lifetime member NRA cap, Dad would have always been out of place at Harvard, but his scarring intensified the effect. I had seen him many times in the years since the explosion, but it wasn't until he came to Harvard and I saw him set against my life there that I realized how severely he'd disfigured himself. That awareness reached me through the eyes of others, strangers whose faces changed when he passed them in the street, who turned to get a second look. Then I would look at him, too, and notice how the skin on his chin was taut and plastic, how his lips lacked natural roundness, how his cheeks sucked inward at an angle that was almost skeletal. His right hand, which he often raised to point at some feature or other, was knotted and twisted, and when I gazed at it, set against Harvard's antediluvian steeples and columns, it seemed to me the claw of some mythical creature. Dad had little interest in the university, so I took him into the city. I taught him how to take the T, how to feed his card through the slot and push through the rotating gate. He laughed out loud, as if it were a fabulous technology. A homeless man passed through our subway car and asked for a dollar. Dad gave him a crisp 50. "You keep that up in Boston, you won't have any money left," I said.
"Doubt it," Dad said with a wink. "The business is rolling. We got more than we can spend."
Because his health was fragile, my father took the bed. I had purchased an air mattress, which I gave to Mother. I slept on the tile floor. Both my parents snored loudly, and I lay awake all night. When the sun finally rose, I stayed on the floor, eyes closed, breathing slow, deep breaths, while my parents ransacked my mini-fridge and discussed me in hushed tones.
"The Lord has commanded me to testify," Dad said. "She may yet be brought to the Lord."
While they plotted how to reconvert me, I plotted how to let them. I was ready to yield, even if it meant an exorcism. A miracle would be useful. If I could stage a convincing rebirth, I could dissociate from everything I'd said and done in the last year. I could take it all back, blame Lucifer, and be given a clean slate. I imagined how esteemed I would be as a newly cleansed vessel, how loved. All I had to do was swap my memories for theirs, and I could have my family. My father wanted to visit the Sacred Grove in Palmyra, New York, the forest where, according to Joseph Smith, God had appeared and commanded him to found the true church. We rented a car and 6 hours later entered Palmyra. Near the grove, off the highway, there was a shimmering temple topped by a golden statue of the angel Moroni. Dad pulled over and asked me to cross the temple grounds.
"Touch the temple," he said. "Its power will cleanse you."
I studied his face. His expression was stretched, earnest, desperate. With all that was in him, he was willing me to touch the temple and be saved. My father and I looked at the temple. He saw God. I saw granite. We looked at each other. He saw a woman damned. I saw an unhinged old man, literally disfigured by his beliefs. And yet, triumphant. I remembered the words of Sancho Panza. "An adventuring knight is someone who's beaten and then finds himself emperor." When I reflect on that moment now, the image blurs, reconstituting itself into that of a zealous knight astride a steed, charging into an imaginary battle, striking its shadows, hacking into thin air. His jaw is set, his back straight, his eyes blaze with conviction, throwing sparks that burn where they lay. My mother gives me a pale, disbelieving look, but when he turns his gaze on her, they become of one mind. Then, they are both tilting at windmills. I crossed the grounds and held my palm to the temple stone. I closed my eyes and tried to believe that this simple act could bring the miracle my parents prayed for. That all I had to do was touch this relic and, by the power of the Almighty, all would be put right. But I felt nothing. Just cold rock. I returned to the car. "Let's go," I said. When life itself seems lunatic, who knows where madness lies? In the days that followed, I wrote that passage everywhere, unconsciously, compulsively. I find it now in books I was reading, in my lecture notes, in the margins of my journal. Its recitation was a mantra. I willed myself to believe it, to believe there was no real difference between what I knew to be true and what I knew to be false. To convince myself that there was some dignity in what I planned to do, in surrendering my own perceptions of right and wrong, of reality, of sanity itself, to earn the love of my parents. For them, I believed I could don armor and charge at giants, even if I saw only windmills. We entered the sacred grove. I walked ahead and found a bench beneath a canopy of trees. It was a lovely wood, heavy with history. It was the reason my ancestors had come to America. A twig snapped. My parents appeared. They sat, one on either side of me. My father spoke for 2 hours. He testified that he had beheld angels and demons. He had seen physical manifestations of evil and had been visited by the Lord Jesus Christ, like the prophets of old, like Joseph Smith had been in this very grove. His faith was no longer a faith, he said, but a perfect knowledge.
"You have been taken by Lucifer,"
he whispered, his hand on my shoulder.
"I could feel it the moment I entered your room."
I thought of my dorm room, of the murky walls and frigid tiles, but also of the sunflowers Drew had sent, and of the textile wall hanging a friend from Zimbabwe had brought from his village. Mother said nothing. She stared at the dirt, her eyes glossy, her lips pursed. Dad prodded me for a response. I searched myself, reaching deep, groping for the words he needed to hear. But they were not in me. Not yet. Before we returned to Harvard, I convinced my parents to take a detour to Niagara Falls. The mood in the car was heavy, and at first I regretted having suggested the diversion. But the moment Dad saw the falls, he was transformed, elated. I had a camera. Dad had always hated cameras, but when he saw mine, his eyes shone with excitement.
"Tara! Tara!"
he shouted, running ahead of me and Mother.
"Get yourself a picture of this angle. Ain't that pretty?"
It was as if he realized we were making a memory, something beautiful we might need later. Or perhaps I'm projecting, because that was how I felt. There are some photos from today that might help me forget the grove, I wrote in my journal. There's a picture of me and Dad happy, together. Proof that's possible. When we returned to Harvard, I offered to pay for a hotel. They refused to go. For a week, we stumbled over one another in my dorm room. Every morning, my father trudged up a flight of stairs to the communal shower in nothing but a small white towel. This would have humiliated me at BYU, but at Harvard, I shrugged. I had transcended embarrassment. What did it matter who saw him, or what he said to them, or how shocked they were? It was his opinion I cared about. He was the one I was losing. Then it was their last night, and still I had not been reborn. Mother and I shuffled around the shared kitchen, making a beef and potato casserole, which we brought into the room on trays. My father studied his plate quietly, as if he were alone. Mother made a few observations about the food, then she laughed nervously and was silent. When we'd finished, Dad said he had a gift for me.
"It's why I came," he said, "to offer you a priesthood blessing."
In Mormonism, the priesthood is God's power to act on earth, to advise, to counsel, to heal the sick, and to cast out demons. It is given to men. This was the moment. If I accepted the blessing, he would cleanse me. He would lay his hands on my head and cast out the evil thing that had made me say what I had said, that had made me unwelcome in my own family. All I had to do was yield, and in 5 minutes, it would be over. I heard myself say no. Dad gaped at me in disbelief. Then he began to testify, not about God, but about Mother. The herbs, he said, were a divine calling from the Lord. Everything that happened to our family, every injury, every near death, was because we had been chosen. We were special. God had orchestrated all of it so we could denounce the medical establishment and testify of his power.
"Remember when Luke burned his leg?"
Dad said, as if I could forget.
"That was the Lord's plan. It was a curriculum for your mother, so she would be ready for what would happen to me."
The explosion, the burn. It was the highest of spiritual honors, he said, to be made a living testament of God's power. Dad held my hands in his mangled fingers and told me that his disfiguration had been foreordained. that it was a tender mercy, that it had brought souls to God. Mother added her testimony in low, reverent whispers. She said she could stop a stroke by adjusting a chakra, that she could halt heart attacks using only energy, that she could cure cancer if people had faith. She herself had had breast cancer, she said, and she had cured it. My head snapped up. "You have cancer?" I said. "You're sure? You had it tested?"
"I didn't need to have it tested," she said. "I muscle tested it. It was cancer. I cured it."
"We could have cured Grandma too," Dad said. "But she turned away from Christ. She lacked faith, and that's why she's dead. God won't heal the faithless."
Mother nodded, but never looked up.
"Grandma's sin was serious," Dad said. "But your sins are more serious still, because you were given the truth and have turned from it."
The room was quiet, except for the dull hum of traffic on Oxford Street. Dad's eyes were fixed on me. It was the gaze of a seer, of a holy oracle whose power and authority were drawn from the very universe. I wanted to meet it head on, to prove I could withstand its weight, but after a few seconds, something in me buckled, some inner force gave way, and my eyes dropped to the floor.
"I am called of God to testify that disaster lies ahead of you," Dad said. "It is coming soon, very soon, and it will break you utterly. It will knock you down into the depths of humility, and when you are there, when you are lying broken, you will call on the Divine Father for mercy."
Dad's voice, which had risen to fever pitch, now fell to a murmur.
"And he will not hear you."
I met his gaze. He was burning with conviction. I could almost feel the heat rolling off him. He leaned forward so that his face was nearly touching mine and said,
"But I will."
The silence settled, undisturbed, oppressive.
"I will offer one final time to give you a blessing," he said.
The blessing was a mercy. He was offering me the same terms of surrender he had offered my sister. I imagined what a relief it must have been for her to realize she could trade her reality, the one she shared with me, for his. How grateful she must have felt to pay such a modest price. I could not judge her for her choice, but in that moment, I knew I could not choose it for myself. Everything I had worked for, all my years of study, had been to purchase for myself this one privilege, to see and experience more truths than those given to me by my father, and to use those truths to construct my own mind. I had come to believe that the ability to evaluate many ideas, many histories, many points of view, was at the heart of what it means to self-create. If I yielded now, I would lose more than an argument. I would lose custody of my own mind. This was the price I was being asked to pay. I understood that now. What my father wanted to cast from me wasn't a demon. It was me. Dad reached into his pocket and withdrew a vial of consecrated oil, which he placed in my palm. I studied it. This oil was the only thing needed to perform the ritual, that and the holy authority resting in my father's misshapen hands. I imagined my surrender, imagined closing my eyes and recanting my blasphemies. I imagined how I would describe my change, my divine transformation, what words of gratitude I would shout. The words were ready, fully formed, and waiting to leave my lips. But when my mouth opened, they vanished. "I love you," I said. "But I can't. I'm sorry, Dad." My father stood abruptly. He said again there was an evil presence in my room, that he couldn't stay another night. Their flight was not until morning, but Dad said it was better to sleep on a bench than with the devil. My mother bustled about the room. shoveling shirts and socks into their suitcase. 5 minutes later, they were gone. Chapter 37. Gambling for Redemption. Someone was screaming, a long, steady holler so loud it woke me up. It was dark. There were streetlights, pavement, the rumble of distant cars. I was standing in the middle of Oxford Street, half a block from my dorm room. My feet were bare, and I was wearing a tank top and flannel pajama bottoms. It felt like people were gawking at me, but it was 2 in the morning, and the street was empty. Somehow, I got back into my building. Then I sat on my bed and tried to reconstruct what had happened. I remembered going to sleep. I remembered the dream. What I did not remember was flying from my bed and sprinting down the hall and into the street, shouting. But that is what I had done. The dream had been of home. Dad had built a maze on Buck's Peak and trapped me inside it. The walls were 10 feet high and made of supplies from his root cellar, sacks of grain, cases of ammunition, drums of honey. I was searching for something, something precious I could never replace. I had to escape the maze to recover it, but I couldn't find the way out, and Dad was pursuing me, sealing the exits with sacks of grain stacked into barricades. I stopped going to my French group, then to my sketching class. Instead of reading in the library or attending lectures, I watched TV in my room, working my way through every popular series from the past 2 decades. When one episode ended, I would begin the next without thinking, the way one breath follows another. I watched TV 18 or 20 hours a day. When I slept, I dreamed of home, and at least once a week, I awoke standing in the street in the middle of the night, wondering if it was my own cry that I'd heard just before waking. I did not study. I tried to read, but the sentences meant nothing. I needed them to mean nothing. I couldn't bear to string sentences into strands of thought, or to weave those strands into ideas. Ideas were too similar to reflection, and my reflections were always of the expression on my father's stretched face the moment before he'd fled from me. The thing about having a mental breakdown is that no matter how obvious it is that you're having one, it is somehow not obvious to you. I'm fine, you think. So what if I watched TV for 24 straight hours yesterday? I'm not falling apart. I'm just lazy. Why it's better to think yourself lazy than think yourself in distress, I'm not sure. But it was better. More than better. It was vital. By December, I was so far behind in my work that, pausing one night to begin a new episode of Breaking Bad, I realized that I might fail my PhD. I laughed maniacally for 10 minutes at this irony, that having sacrificed my family to my education, I might lose that also. After a few more weeks of this, I stumbled from my bed one night and decided that I had made a mistake, that when my father had offered me the blessing, I should have accepted it. But it wasn't too late. I could repair the damage, put it right. I purchased a ticket to Idaho for Christmas. 2 days before the flight, I awoke in a cold sweat. I dreamed I was in a hospital, lying on crisp white sheets. Dad was at the foot of the gurney, telling a policeman I had stabbed myself. Mother echoed him, her eyes panicked. I was surprised to hear Drew's voice, shouting that I needed to be moved to another hospital. "He'll find her here," he kept saying. I wrote to Drew, who was living in the Middle East. I told him I was going to Buck's Peak. When he replied, his tone was urgent and sharp, as if he was trying to cut through whatever fog I was living in. "My dear Tara," he wrote, "if Sean stabs you, you won't be taken to a hospital. You'll be put in the basement and given some lavender for the wound." He begged me not to go, saying 100 things I already knew and didn't care about, and when that didn't work, he said, "You told me your story so I could stop you if you ever did something crazy. Well, Tara, this is it. This is crazy." "I can still fix this," I chanted as the plane lifted off the tarmac. It was a bright winter morning when I arrived on Buck's Peak. I remember the crisp smell of frozen earth as I approached the house and the feel of ice and gravel crunching beneath my boots. The sky was a shocking blue. I breathed in the welcome scent of pine. My gaze dropped below the mountain, and my breath caught. When Grandma had been alive, she had, by nagging, shouting, and threats, kept my father's junkyard contained. Now refuse covered the farm and was creeping toward the mountain base. The rolling hills, once perfect lakes of snow, were dotted with mangled trucks and rusted septic tanks. Mother was ecstatic when I stepped through the door. I hadn't told her I was coming, hoping that, if no one knew, I might avoid Sean. She talked rapidly, nervously.
"I'm going to make you biscuits and gravy," she said, then flew to the kitchen.
"I'll help in a minute," I said. "I just need to send an email." The family computer was in the old part of the house, what had been the front room before the renovation. I sat down to write Drew, because I'd promised, as a kind of compromise between us, that while on the mountain, I would write to him every 2 hours. I nudged the mouse, and the screen flickered on. The browser was already open. Someone had forgotten to sign out. I moved to open a different browser, but stopped when I saw my name. It was in the message that was open on the screen, which Mother had sent only moments before, to Sean's ex-girlfriend, Erin. The premise of the message was that Sean had been reborn, spiritually cleansed, that the atonement had healed our family, and that all had been restored. All except me. "The Spirit has whispered to me the truth about my daughter," Mother wrote. "My poor child has given herself over to fear, and that fear has made her desperate to validate her misperceptions. I do not know if she is a danger to our family, but I have reasons to think she might be." The language in the description of the referenced email exchange is paraphrased, not directly quoted. I had known, even before reading the message, that my mother shared my father's dark vision, that she believed the devil had a hold of me, that I was dangerous. But there was something in seeing the words on the page, in reading them and hearing her voice in them, the voice of my mother, that turned my body cold. There was more to the email. In the final paragraph, Mother described the birth of Emily's second child, a daughter who had been born a month before. Mother had midwifed the child. The birth had taken place at home, and, according to Mother, Emily had nearly bled to death before they could get to a hospital. Mother finished the story by testifying, "God had worked through her hands that night," she said. "The birth was a testament of his power." I remembered the drama of Peter's birth, how he'd slipped out of Emily weighing little more than a pound, how he'd been such a shocking shade of gray they'd thought he was dead, how they'd fought through a snowstorm to the hospital in town, only to be told it wasn't enough and there were no choppers flying, how 2 ambulances had been dispatched to McKD in Ogden, that a woman with this medical history, a woman so obviously high risk, should be advised to attempt a second birth at home seemed reckless to the point of delusion. If the first fall was God's will, whose was the second? I was still wondering at the birth of my niece when Erin's response appeared. "You are right about Tara," she said. "She is lost without faith." Erin told Mother that my doubting myself, my writing to her, Erin, to ask if I might be mistaken, if my memories might be false, was evidence that my soul was in jeopardy, that I couldn't be trusted. "She is building her life on fear. I will pray for her." Erin ended the message by praising my mother's skill as a midwife. "You are a true hero," she wrote. I closed the browser and stared at the wallpaper behind the screen. It was the same floral print from my childhood. For how long had I been dreaming of seeing it? I had come to reclaim that life, to save it. But there was nothing here to save, nothing to grasp. There was only shifting sand, shifting loyalties, shifting histories. I remembered the dream, the maze. I remembered the walls made of grain sacks and ammunition boxes, of my father's fears and paranoias, his scriptures and prophecies. I had wanted to escape the maze with its disorienting switchbacks, its ever-modulating pathways, to find the precious thing. But now I understood. The precious thing? That was the maze. That's all that was left of the life I'd had here. A puzzle whose rules I would never understand, because they were not rules at all, but a kind of cage meant to enclose me. I could stay and search for what had been home, or I could go, now, before the walls shifted and the way out was shut. Mother was sliding biscuits into the oven when I entered the kitchen. I looked around, mentally searching the house. What do I need from this place? There was only one thing. My memories. I found them under my bed, in a box where I had left them. I carried them to the car and put them in the back seat. I'm going for a drive, I told Mother. I tried to keep my voice smooth. I hugged her, then took a long look at Buck's Peak, memorizing every line and shadow. Mother had seen me take my journals to the car. She must have known what that meant, must have sensed the farewell in it, because she fetched my father. He gave me a stiff hug and said,
I love you. Do you know that?
I do, I said. That has never been the issue. Those words are the last I said to my father. I drove south. I didn't know where I was going. It was nearly Christmas. I had decided to go to the airport and board the next flight to Boston when Tyler called. I hadn't spoken to my brother in months. After what happened with Audrey, it had seemed pointless to confide in my siblings. I was sure Mother would have told every brother, cousin, aunt, and uncle the story she had told Aaron, that I was possessed, dangerous, taken by the devil. I wasn't wrong. Mother had warned them. But then she made a mistake. After I left Buck's Peak, she panicked. She was afraid I might contact Tyler, and that if I did, he might sympathize with me. She decided to get to Tyler first, to deny anything I might tell him, but she miscalculated. She didn't stop to think how the denials would sound, coming from nowhere like that.
Of course Sean didn't stab Diego and threaten Tara with the knife, Mother reassured Tyler.
But to Tyler, who had never heard any part of this story, not from me or anyone else, this was somewhat less than reassuring. A moment after he said goodbye to Mother, Tyler called me, demanding to know what had happened and why I hadn't come to him. I thought he'd say I was lying, but he didn't. He accepted almost immediately the reality I'd spent a year denying. I didn't understand why he was trusting me, but then he told me his own stories, and I remembered. Sean had been his older brother, too. In the weeks that followed, Tyler began to test my parents in the subtle, non-confrontational way that was uniquely his. He suggested that perhaps the situation had been mishandled, that perhaps I was not possessed, perhaps I was not evil at all. I might have taken comfort in Tyler's trying to help me, but the memory of my sister was too raw, and I didn't trust him. I knew that if Tyler confronted my parents, really confronted them, they would force him to choose between me and them, between me and the rest of the family. And from Audrey, I had learned, he would not choose me. My fellowship at Harvard finished in the spring. I flew to the Middle East, where Drew was completing a Fulbright. It took some effort, but I managed to hide from Drew how poorly I was doing, or at least I thought I did. I probably didn't. He was, after all, the one chasing me through his flat when I awoke in the middle of the night, screaming and sprinting, with no idea where I was, but a desperate need to escape it. We left Amman and drove south. We were in a Bedouin camp in the Jordanian desert on the day the Navy SEALs killed bin Laden. Drew spoke Arabic, and when the news broke, he spent hours in conversation with our guides. He's no Muslim, they told Drew as we sat on cold sand, watching the dying flames of a campfire. He does not understand Islam, or he would not do the terrible things he's done. I watched Drew talk with the Bedouins, heard the strange, smooth sounds falling from his lips, and was struck by the implausibility of my presence there. When the Twin Towers had fallen 10 years before, I had never heard of Islam. Now I was drinking sugary tea with Salabia Bedouins and squatting on a sand drift in Wadi Rum, the Valley of the Moon, less than 20 miles from the Saudi Arabian border. The distance, physical and mental, that had been traversed in the last decade nearly stopped my breath, and I wondered if perhaps I had changed too much. All my studying, reading, thinking, traveling, had it transformed me into someone who no longer belonged anywhere? I thought of the girl who, knowing nothing beyond her junkyard and her mountain, had stared at a screen, watching as two planes sailed into strange white pillars. Her classroom was a heap of junk, her textbooks, slates of scrap. And yet she had something precious that I, despite all my opportunities, or maybe because of them, did not. I returned to England, where I continued to unravel. My first week back in Cambridge, I awoke nearly every night in the street, having run there, shouting, asleep. I developed headaches that lasted for days. My dentist said I was grinding my teeth. My skin broke out so severely that twice perfect strangers stopped me in the street and asked if I was having an allergic reaction. "No," I said, "I always look like this." One evening, I got into an argument with a friend about something trivial, and before I knew what was happening, I had pressed myself into the wall and was hugging my knees to my chest, trying to keep my heart from leaping out of my body. My friend rushed toward me to help, and I screamed. It was an hour before I could let her touch me, before I could will myself away from the wall. "So that's a panic attack," I thought the next morning. Soon after, I sent a letter to my father. I'm not proud of that letter. It's full of rage, a fractious child screaming, "I hate you," at a parent. It's filled with words like thug and tyrant, and it goes on for pages, a torrent of frustration and abuse. That is how I told my parents I was cutting off contact with them. Between insults and fits of temper, I said I needed a year to heal myself. Then perhaps I could return to their mad world to try to make sense of it. My mother begged me to find another way. My father said nothing. Chapter 38. Family. I was failing my PhD. If I had explained to my supervisor, Dr. Runciman, why I was unable to work, he would have helped me, would have secured additional funding, petitioned the department for more time. But I didn't explain. I couldn't. He had no idea why it had been nearly a year since I'd sent him work, so when we met in his office one overcast July afternoon, he suggested that I quit.
"The PhD is exceptionally demanding," he said. "It's okay if you can't do it."
I left his office full of fury at myself. I went to the library and gathered half a dozen books, which I lugged to my room and arranged on my desk. But my mind was made nauseous by rational thought, and by the next morning, the books had moved to my bed, where they propped up my laptop while I worked steadily through Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That autumn, Tyler confronted my father. He talked to Mother first on the phone. He called me after and related their conversation. He said Mother was on our side, that she thought the situation with Sean was unacceptable, and had convinced Dad to do something.
"Dad is taking care of it," Tyler said. "Everything is going to be fine. You can come home."
My phone rang again 2 days later, and I paused Buffy to answer it. It was Tyler. The whole thing had exploded in his face. He had felt uneasy after his conversation with Mother, so he had called Dad to see exactly what was being done about Sean. Dad had become angry, aggressive. He'd shouted at Tyler that if he brought this up again, he would be disowned. Then he'd hung up the phone. I dislike imagining this conversation. Tyler's stutter was always worse when he talked to our father. I picture my brother hunched over the receiver, trying to concentrate, to push out the words that have jammed in his throat, while his father hurls an arsenal of ugly words. Tyler was still reeling from Dad's threat when his phone rang. He thought it was Dad calling to apologize, but it was Sean. Dad had told him everything.
I can have you out of this family in 2 minutes,
Sean said.
You know I can do it. Just ask Tara.
I listened to Tyler relate this story while staring at the frozen image of Sarah Michelle Gellar. Tyler talked for a long time, moving through the events quickly, but lingering in a wasteland of rationalization and self-recrimination. Dad must have misunderstood, Tyler said. There had been a mistake, a miscommunication. Maybe it was his fault. Maybe he hadn't said the right thing in the right way. That was it. He had done this, and he could repair it. As I listened, I felt a strange sensation of distance that bordered on disinterestedness, as if my future with Tyler, this brother I had known and loved all my life, was a film I had already seen and knew the ending of. I knew the shape of this drama because I had lived it already, with my sister. This was the moment I had lost Audrey. This was the moment the costs had become real, when the tax was levied, the rent due. This was the moment she had realized how much easier it was to walk away. What a poor trade it was to swap an entire family for a single sister. So I knew even before it happened that Tyler would go the same way. I could hear his hand ringing through the long echo of the telephone. He was deciding what to do, but I knew something he did not. That the decision had already been made, and what he was doing now was just the long work of justifying it. It was October when I got the letter. It came in the form of a PDF attached to an email from Tyler and Stephanie. The message explained that the letter had been drafted carefully, thoughtfully, and that a copy would be sent to my parents. When I saw that, I knew what it meant. It meant Tyler was ready to denounce me, to say my father's words that I was possessed, dangerous. The letter was a kind of voucher, a pass that would admit him back into the family. I couldn't get myself to open the attachment. Some instinct had seized my fingers. I remembered Tyler as he'd been when I was young, the quiet older brother reading his books while I lay under his desk, staring at his socks and breathing in his music. I wasn't sure I could bear it, to hear those words in his voice. I clicked the mouse. The attachment opened. I was so far removed from myself that I read the entire letter without understanding it. Our parents are held down by chains of abuse, manipulation, and control. They see change as dangerous and will exile anyone who asks for it. This is a perverted idea of family loyalty. They claim faith, but this is not what the gospel teaches. Keep safe. We love you. From Tyler's wife, Stephanie, I would learn the story of this letter, how in the days after my father had threatened disownment, Tyler had gone to bed every night saying aloud to himself over and over, "What am I supposed to do? She's my sister." When I heard this story, I made the only good decision I had made for months. I enrolled in the university counseling service. I was assigned to a sprightly, middle-aged woman with tight curls and sharp eyes, who rarely spoke in our sessions, preferring to let me talk it out, which I did, week after week, month after month. The counseling did nothing at first. I can't think of a single session I would describe as helpful, but their collective power over time was undeniable. I didn't understand it then, and I don't understand it now, but there was something nourishing in setting aside that time each week, in the act of admitting that I needed something I could not provide for myself. Tyler did send the letter to my parents, and once committed, he never wavered. That winter, I spent many hours on the phone with him and Stephanie, who became a sister to me. They were available whenever I needed to talk, and back then, I needed to talk quite a lot. Tyler paid a price for that letter, though the price is hard to define. He was not disowned, or at least his disownment was not permanent. Eventually, he worked out a truce with my father, but their relationship may never be the same. I've apologized to Tyler more times than I can count for what I've cost him, but the words are awkwardly placed, and I stumble over them. What is the proper arrangement of words? How do you craft an apology for weakening someone's ties to his father, to his family? Perhaps there aren't words for that. How do you thank a brother who refused to let you go, who seized your hand and wrenched you upward just as you had decided to stop kicking and sink? There aren't words for that either. Winter was long that year. The dreariness punctuated only by my weekly counseling sessions and the odd sense of loss, almost bereavement, I felt whenever I finished one TV series and had to find another. Then it was spring, then summer, and finally, as summer turned to fall, I found I could read with focus. I could hold thoughts in my head besides anger and self-accusation. I returned to the chapter I had written nearly 2 years before at Harvard. Again, I read Hume, Rousseau, Smith, Godwin, Wollstonecraft, and Mill. Again, I thought about the family. There was a puzzle in it, something unresolved. What is a person to do, I asked, when their obligations to their family conflict with other obligations, to friends, to society, to themselves? I began the research. I narrowed the question, made it academic, specific. In the end, I chose four intellectual movements from the 19th century and examined how they had struggled with the question of family obligation. One of the movements I chose was 19th century Mormonism. I worked for a solid year, and at the end of it, I had a draft of my thesis, The Family, Morality, and Social Science in Anglo-American Cooperative Thought, 1813 to 1890. The chapter on Mormonism was my favorite. As a child in Sunday school, I'd been taught that all history was a preparation for Mormonism, that every event since the death of Christ had been fashioned by God to make possible the moment when Joseph Smith would kneel in the sacred grove and God would restore the one true church. Wars, migrations, natural disasters, these were mere preludes to the Mormon story. On the other hand, secular histories tended to overlook spiritual movements like Mormonism altogether. My dissertation gave a different shape to history, one that was neither Mormon nor anti-Mormon, neither spiritual nor profane. It didn't treat Mormonism as the objective of human history, but neither did it discount the contribution Mormonism had made in grappling with the questions of the age. Instead, it treated the Mormon ideology as a chapter in the larger human story. In my account, history did not set Mormons apart from the rest of the human family. It bound them to it. I sent Dr. Runciman the draft, and a few days later we met in his office. He sat across from me and, with a look of astonishment, said it was good.
"Some parts of it are very good," he said.
He was smiling now.
"I'll be surprised if it doesn't earn a doctorate."
As I walked home, carrying the heavy manuscript, I remembered attending one of Dr. Carey's lectures, which he had begun by writing, "Who Writes History?" on the blackboard. I remembered how strange the question had seemed to me then. My idea of a historian was not human. It was of someone like my father, more prophet than man, whose visions of the past, like those of the future, could not be questioned or even augmented. Now, as I passed through King's College in the shadow of the enormous chapel, my old diffidence seemed almost funny. Who writes history? I thought. I do. On my 27th birthday, the birthday I had chosen, I submitted my PhD dissertation. The defense took place in December, in a small, simply furnished room. I passed and returned to London, where Drew had a job and we'd rented a flat. In January, nearly 10 years to the day since I'd set foot in my first classroom at BYU, I received confirmation from the University of Cambridge. I was Dr. Westover. I had built a new life, and it was a happy one, but I felt a sense of loss that went beyond family. I had lost Buck's Peak, not by leaving, but by leaving silently. I had retreated, fled across an ocean, and allowed my father to tell my story for me, to define me to everyone I had ever known. I had conceded too much ground, not just the mountain, but the entire province of our shared history. It was time to go home. Chapter 39. Watching the Buffalo. It was spring when I arrived in the valley. I drove along the highway to the edge of town, then pulled over at the drop-off overlooking the Bear River. From there, I could look out over the basin, a patchwork of expectant fields stretching to Buck's Peak. The mountain was crisp with evergreens, which were luminous set against the browns and grays of shale and limestone. The princess was as bright as I'd ever seen her. She stood facing me, the valley between us, radiating permanence. The princess had been haunting me. From across the ocean, I'd heard her beckoning, as if I were a troublesome calf who'd wandered from her herd. Her voice had been gentle at first, coaxing, but when I didn't answer, when I stayed away, it had turned to fury. I had betrayed her. I imagined her face contorted with rage, her stance heavy and threatening. She had been living in my mind like this for years, a deity of contempt. But seeing her now, standing watch over her fields and pastures, I realized that I had misunderstood her. She was not angry with me for leaving, because leaving was a part of her cycle. Her role was not to corral the buffalo, not to gather and confine them by force. It was to celebrate their return. I backtracked a quarter mile into town and parked beside Grandma over in town's white picket fence. In my mind, it was still her fence, even though she didn't live here anymore. She had been moved to a hospice facility near Main Street. I had not seen my grandparents in 3 years, not since my parents had begun telling the extended family that I was possessed. My grandparents loved their daughter. I was sure they had believed her account of me, so I had surrendered them. It was too late to reclaim Grandma. She was suffering from Alzheimer's and would not have known me, so I had come to see my grandfather, to find out whether there would be a place for me in his life. We sat in the living room. The carpet was the same crisp white from my childhood. The visit was short and polite. He talked about Grandma, whom he had cared for long after she ceased to recognize him. I talked about England. Grandpa mentioned my mother, and when he spoke of her, it was with the same look of awe that I had seen in the faces of her followers. I didn't blame him. From what I'd heard, my parents were powerful people in the valley. Mother was marketing her products as a spiritual alternative to Obamacare, and she was selling product as fast as she could make it, even with dozens of employees. God had to be behind such a wondrous success, Grandpa said. My parents must have been called by the Lord to do what they have done, to be great healers, to bring souls to God. I smiled and stood to go. He was the same gentle old man I remembered, but I was overwhelmed by the distance between us. I hugged him at the door and gave him a long look. He was 87. I doubted whether, in the years he had left, I would be able to prove to him that I was not what my father said I was, that I was not a wicked thing. Tyler and Stephanie lived 100 miles north of Buck's Peak, in Idaho Falls. It was there I planned to go next, but before leaving the valley, I wrote my mother. It was a short message. I said I was nearby and wanted her to meet me in town. I wasn't ready to see Dad, I said, but it had been years since I'd seen her face. Would she come? I waited for her reply in the parking lot at Stokes. I didn't wait long. The language in the description of the referenced exchange is paraphrased, not directly quoted. It pains me that you think it is acceptable to ask this. A wife does not go where her husband is not welcome. I will not be party to such blatant disrespect. The message was long, and reading it made me tired, as if I'd run a great distance. The bulk of it was a lecture on loyalty, that families forgive, and that if I could not forgive mine, I would regret it for the rest of my life. The past, she wrote, whatever it was, ought to be shoveled 50 feet under and left to rot in the earth. Mother said I was welcome to come to the house, that she prayed for the day when I would run through the back door, shouting, "I'm home." I wanted to answer her prayer. I was barely more than 10 miles from the mountain, but I knew what unspoken pact I would be making as I walked through that door. I could have my mother's love, but there were terms, the same terms they had offered me 3 years before, that I trade my reality for theirs, that I take my own understanding and bury it, leave it to rot in the earth. Mother's message amounted to an ultimatum. I could see her and my father, or I would never see her again. She has never recanted. The parking lot had filled while I was reading. I let her words settle, then started the engine and pulled onto Main Street. At the intersection, I turned west, toward the mountain. Before I left the valley, I would set eyes on my home. Over the years, I had heard many rumors about my parents, that they were millionaires, that they were building a fortress on the mountain, that they had hidden away enough food to last decades. The most interesting, by far, were the stories about Dad hiring and firing employees. The valley had never recovered from the recession. People needed work. My parents were one of the largest employers in the county, but from what I could tell, Dad's mental state made it difficult for him to maintain employees long-term. When he had a fit of paranoia, he tended to fire people with little cause. Months before, he had fired Diane Hardy, Rob's ex-wife, the same Rob who'd come to fetch us after the second accident. Diane and Rob had been friends with my parents for 20 years, until Dad fired Diane. It was perhaps in another such fit of paranoia that Dad fired my mother's sister, Angie. Angie had spoken to Mother, believing her sister would never treat family that way. When I was a child, it had been Mother's business. Now it was hers and Dad's together. But at this test of whose it was really, my father won. Angie was dismissed. It is difficult to piece together what happened next, but from what I later learned, Angie filed for unemployment benefits, and when the Department of Labor called my parents to confirm that she had been terminated, Dad lost what little reason remained to him. It was not the Department of Labor on the phone, he said, but the Department of Homeland Security, pretending to be the Department of Labor. Angie had put his name on the terrorist watch list, he said. The government was after him now, after his money and his guns and his fuel. It was Ruby Ridge all over again. I pulled off the highway and onto the gravel, then stepped out of the car and gazed up at Buck's Peak. It was clear immediately that at least some of the rumors were true. For one, that my parents were making huge sums of money. The house was massive. The home I'd grown up in had had 5 bedrooms. Now it had been expanded in all directions and looked as though it had at least 40. It would only be a matter of time, I thought, before Dad started using the money to prepare for the end of days. I imagined the roof lined with solar panels, laid out like a deck of cards.
"We need to be self-sufficient,"
I imagined Dad would say as he dragged the panels across his Titanic house. In the coming year, Dad would spend hundreds of thousands of dollars buying equipment and scouring the mountain for water. He didn't want to be dependent on the government, and he knew Buck's Peak must have water if he could only find it. Gashes the size of football fields would appear at the mountain base, leaving a desolation of broken roots and upturned trees where once there had been a forest. He was probably chanting, "Got to be self-reliant," the day he climbed into a crawler and tore into the fields of satin wheat. Grandma over in town died on Mother's Day. I was doing research in Colorado when I heard the news. I left immediately for Idaho, but while traveling, realized I had nowhere to stay. It was then that I remembered my Aunt Angie, and that my father was telling anyone who would listen that she had put his name on a terrorist watch list. Mother had cast her aside. I hoped I could reclaim her. Angie lived next door to my grandfather, so again I parked along the white picket fence. I knocked. Angie greeted me politely, the way Grandpa had done. It was clear that she had heard much about me from my mother and father in the past 5 years. "I'll make you a deal," I said. "I'll forget everything my dad has said about you, if you'll forget everything he said about me. She laughed, closing her eyes and throwing back her head in a way that nearly broke my heart. She looked so much like my mother. I stayed with Angie until the funeral. In the days